commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. I call our third case today, 01-3393 CR State v. Gary M.B. Christopher Kelly arguing for the defendant, Gary M.B.
May it please the Court, my name is Chris Kelly. I represent Gary Bassett in this appeal from a conviction of three counts of sexual assault of a minor. We are asking the Court in this case to resolve a serious conflict that the Court of Appeals created in Wisconsin law that affects both civil and criminal cases. There are now two rules of law in Wisconsin that are fundamentally inconsistent with each other. The first is a rule that is a rule of long standing, that has been the law in Wisconsin for a long time, and that is the presumption that criminal convictions make a witness less credible and that multiple convictions have a cumulative effect on credibility, so that the more convictions a witness has, the less credible that witness becomes. That presumption has been called by this Court the long-standing view of Wisconsin law, and that presumption applies in civil and criminal cases. In this case, however, Mr. Bassett's case, the Court of Appeals created a second rule of law, and that is that the erroneous introduction of extra convictions to impeach the credibility of a witness is almost always harmless. I suggest that those two concepts, those two rules, are simply inconsistent with each other. It is impossible for them to both be true. The erroneous introduction of evidence that presumptively makes a witness less credible cannot be harmless if the credibility of that witness is important to the outcome of the case.
Counselor, can it be that just generally, there's not a difference between two convictions and five convictions in regard to the inference that the witness is less credible? In other words, once you're convicted of a crime, you're presumed to be less credible. What makes you think it's inconsistent to say that, well, five is harmless error? In other words, if you're judged incredible by one, I don't quite understand why you think it's inconsistent to say it's harmless error to put five in, you're still judged incredible, according to your argument.
Because Wisconsin's counting rule doesn't hold that the mere fact of a conviction is what damages credibility. Wisconsin's counting rule says that each additional conviction makes the witness less credible. And that is the presumption in Wisconsin. So a person who has two convictions is less credible than a person who has one. A person who has three is less credible than a person who has two, and so on. A person with five, it seems to me, is, if you believe that presumption, a lot less credible than a person who only has two.
Good. Thank you.
What do you base that on? That it's not the mere fact of a single conviction, but that you have incremental incredibilities.
This Court stated that that was the rule, that was the presumption in State versus Kuntz, a 1991 decision cited in our brief. The Court of Appeals said that that was true in State versus Smith, a 1996 decision that is cited in our brief. And the legal commentators, Blinka, for instance, in his treatise on evidence, trace the history of Wisconsin's rule, and all of those authorities say the same thing, which is that the long-standing view in Wisconsin is that the number is important to credibility and that the cumulative number is important to credibility. If it weren't, we wouldn't be asking witnesses, how many times have you been convicted? We would only ask them, have you ever been convicted of a crime? They would say yes. If the number didn't have some additional bearing on credibility, the number would not be relevant, and it would not be admissible to ask the witness, how many times have you been convicted?
Mr. Kelly, do you think that we ought to have a bright-line rule, that it would be easier for the administration of justice if we had a rule such as the federal rule and said anything more than 10 years and it doesn't come in, you can't consider it, you can't list it among the numbers?
I think that would be a great rule. I think it would be easier for judges to sort through these issues and decide which conviction should be admissible and which should not. But that doesn't really get to the harmless error problem that we have in this case. Even if the judge had been applying a bright-line rule, I think there isn't much doubt here that the judge erred because the judge didn't give any consideration to the factors about whether these convictions should be admitted or not admitted. Now, maybe the judge wouldn't have erred if he had a bright-line rule.
Well, looking at the harmless error rule in this case, do you think that the Court of Appeals was off base when they were saying, look, the number of convictions, the fact of prior convictions really wasn't emphasized? It was mentioned by both counsel, but it wasn't emphasized. It wasn't something that dominated the trial. Are they wrong in taking that approach?
I think so, because an error doesn't have to dominate the trial to still have an impact on the outcome of the case. The fact that the error exists is important, and I think we know, just as a matter of human nature, that if the jury hears that somebody has been convicted of a crime, they don't have to hear that over and over again. It's not the kind of evidence that juries forget. In fact, the jury studies that I reference in my brief say that, that juries give great weight to the fact that, or to the knowledge that a witness has been convicted of a crime. So I don't think that it's fair to say that this didn't have an impact simply because it wasn't a point that was brought out over and over again. The standard for harmless error, which this Court has debated for some time, and I'm not sure if that debate is resolved or not. It appears that it may have been. But the standard is whether a court can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the error contributed to the verdict. And in the Diaz decision, this Court said that if there is a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction, that is enough to undermine confidence and enough to create that reasonable doubt. This Court has stated that the reasonable doubt standard is still the law. That was the standard articulated by the United States Supreme Court in Chapman. Diaz tells us that the question of whether there's a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the verdict plays into that, and that seems to be the standard that this Court most recently articulated a couple of months ago in the Norman decision.
Which one?
So, State versus Norman.
Okay, now, I understand why you stress this, but if I read the State's brief correctly, and we'll ask Ms. Nashold, the State agrees with you as to the standard, and that the difference between you is the application of the standard of the facts of this case.
I think that is the case. I don't want to speak for the State as to whether it agrees with me or not, but I read the brief as not stating the standard terribly differently from the way I have stated it.
Could you elucidate what error occurred here at trial? Could you make that abundantly clear to me what error
Sure.
occurred?
Prior to the time that Mr. Bassett testified, there was a motion brought before the trial court to determine how many of his convictions, if any, should be used to impeach him. Defense counsel did not challenge Mr. Bassett's two most recent convictions, which I think were in 1991. She did challenge convictions from 1973 for issuing worthless check, 1975 for disorderly conduct, and 1977 for assault. The trial court basically held that there is a presumption in Wisconsin in favor of admissibility of convictions, and that is true, but the court stopped at that point. It did not apply the five-factor test that this court has articulated, which requires the trial court to look at the lapse of time since those convictions, whether the defendant has been rehabilitated, the gravity of those offenses, whether they involve dishonesty or false statements, and a balancing of their prejudicial impact versus their probative value. The court didn't look at any of those factors to decide whether to admit it. It simply stopped with the presumption.
What is it that defense counsel said constituted unfair prejudice that substantially outweighed the probative value of
its
those convictions?
The fact that the jury heard during the course of the trial that the defendant had five convictions, when in fact, had the correct test been applied,
but
only two of those would have been admissible.
What did defense counsel say to the judge was the prejudice?
I'm not sure. I guess I don't remember specifically what her argument was. I think that the general argument was that the convictions were too stale and too minor to be fairly counted against him.
Well, I think counsel said the convictions in the 1970s, since it has been quite some time since those convictions, quite some time since those occurred. That was one point.
Mm-hmm.
Just distance in time.
Right.
And that they do not go toward truthfulness.
Okay.
Because that's probably true of the most recent ones, isn't it?
I think it probably was, and I think she probably had a basis for challenging the most recent ones, but she didn't.
But haven't our courts said that all convictions bear on credibility?
I'm sorry, hasn't? Yes, this court has said all convictions bear on credibility.
Well, what I'm trying to get at is this. I want you to tell me exactly what the job of defense counsel is. Let's say we have a murder case.
Mm-hmm.
And someone has committed a previous murder and been convicted of that. And it was 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
35 years ago. The person's been in prison. But in any event, it's 35 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is it enough simply to say, that's 35 years ago? You can't impeach on that. Do you have to say anything more than that?
Well, if you're asking me what the job of defense counsel is, I think the job of defense counsel is to try to keep it out, because that's what best serves the client. And counsel would be arguing in favor of those factors that would support keeping it out, which would include the lapse of time. And if the defendant had, in fact, not repeated any of that behavior, arguably it would go to rehabilitation of the defendant. So there would be factors that the defense would be arguing to try to keep it out.
Let me try to come right to the point. Did defense counsel, in dealing with the trial judge, explain why the three convictions were prejudicial and that prejudice substantially outweighed the value for impeachment purposes, other than simply saying, those are 20, 27, 25, 23 years ago?
I don't know if she focused so much explicitly, at least, on that factor out of the five factors that the court was to consider. I think she focused more on the lapse of time, on the gravity of the offenses. In other words, these are minor offenses, and pointing out that none of them had anything to do with perjury, false statements, dishonesty in that sense. So I think she was focusing on the three factors that she probably viewed as being the strongest. Nonetheless, it's the judge's job to apply the test correctly, and here the judge didn't apply the test at all. The judge simply said, there is a presumption, so they should come in, and didn't look at any of the factors beyond the presumption.
Well, what I'm really trying to get at here is this. If defense counsel says that those convictions are dated, those are 25 years old, does the judge have to press any more, or does the defense counsel have to press any more buttons than that? I mean, is that putting a quarter in the slot and then the entire script has to come out of the mouth of the judge?
Well, I think that defense counsel raised the issue and made a sufficient argument to put the court on notice as to the defense position. And that, I think, is all the defense has to do in terms of preserving the error. Perhaps defense counsel could have made a better argument or a more detailed argument that would have addressed each of the five factors. I don't think the State made an argument that addressed each of the five factors either. But having placed the court on notice as to what the issue was, yeah, I think at that point it's the court's obligation to apply the law correctly. And the judge here didn't apply the law at all beyond saying there's a presumption, therefore they're admitted. The judge essentially has, at least in this case, a policy of automatic admission of all past criminal convictions. And that is not the law in the State of Wisconsin. So when this issue was brought to the judge and the judge was asked to exclude convictions and was told at least some of the factors that favored exclusion, I think it was the obligation of the judge to apply the correct test.
I thought the error in this case was as follows. The judge was presented with these five convictions. The judge understood that it was in his or her discretion to allow them or not allow them on the basis of whether he thought they were relevant to proving credibility. The statute says they generally are relevant, but the case law seems to say maybe sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. So if they're very old, they don't seem to be relevant enough. Okay. And the judge made that decision. Now, it's certainly arguable from the record that the way the judge explained the decision is not as full and complete rationale as one might in an ideal world, and maybe not so ideal world, hope for. And that the error here, and that you can support the judge's discretionary holding there as an appellate court by looking at the record. And if the facts support the holding, support the judge. But the error here is that the judge did not take the second step that the court has to take, which is that it did not make the balance. And there it chose no exercise of discretion in making the balance. And that the general rule, and I think that's footnote 6 in the opinion here, is that the general rule is that if the court never exercises its discretion, the appellate court can't go back and look at it. So am I wrong in dividing these up into two discretionary decisions, or is it really only one ball of wax? You look at all of it.
Well, I tend to view it as one ball of wax in this case because I don't think that I'm sure the judge understood that this was a discretionary decision, but I don't think the judge exercised discretion at any point, discretion being defined as the meaningful application of a legal test to the facts of the case by the use of reasoning. I don't think that happened here. The judge simply applied what appears to be an automatic presumption that the fact of prior convictions is admissible. That's presumed to be the case. Yet the discretionary test that the judge should have applied required the judge to look at five factors and to weigh those five factors against each other and decide, again, applying a process of legal reasoning, whether in this case these convictions should have been admitted. The judge just didn't do that.
Counsel, in preparing for this case, I was thinking about what perhaps Justice Prosser and Chief Justice Abrahamson were also exploring. That is, the question kept on coming up in my mind, what is the error here? Is the error here the failure to exercise discretion, that is, failure to engage in the mandated balancing test? Or is the error here the admission of evidence that maybe shouldn't have been deemed relevant because it was stale and because it was inconsequential to truthfulness or whatever argument you want to make. And it seems to me that there is a difference. And what I've been toying with in my mind is, what is the difference? Now, maybe a difference is how this case plays out in terms of a harmless error analysis. I'm not sure, but maybe that is the difference. That is, as if I recall this case, and we read a few of them, as I recall this case, maybe this isn't the one, but when there is no record which demonstrates any exercise of discretion, then oftentimes this court will say, hey, you know, we can't do it. There's no evidentiary record that demonstrated any exercise of discretion. And then you can't get to the position necessarily of calling the error harmless. If the error is the admission of evidence, I don't have this totally thought out, but it seems to me you maybe more easily get to the harmless error analysis and have the court search the record to see if there is evidence which would have supported the discretionary determination. But here, when you have a mandated exercise of discretion, violation of that is arguably the error rather than the admission. Does that take you any place, or am I just going in circles?
Well, I guess I view it as the first error leading to the second. I think if the judge had exercised discretion, the judge would have concluded, because it's, I think, the only reasonable conclusion, that the three convictions should not be admitted. So because the judge did not exercise discretion at all, the three convictions were erroneously admitted into evidence. I'm not sure I see a clear distinction between the two kinds of error here.
Counselor, when I first asked you about what makes you think that the more convictions you are, the less credible you are, you cited some cases, and I thought one was State versus Kunz, our decision in 1991. Did I misunderstand your citation?
That's correct.
Yeah. All right. Well, I read Kunz a couple of weeks ago, and it does happen to be something that I just happen to have with me now. And there's only one conviction that was entered in Kunz. The 83 conviction, the 1970 conviction, was kept out, and I see no language there that says if you have two convictions, you're less credible than if you have one. If you have three, you're less than if you have two. Can you maybe point that out to me, please?
I'm not sure I can give you a page cite right now. Blinka's treatise on evidence talks about the counting rule.
Is there any other decision of this court besides Kunz where you think that proposition is stated?
The Kruzycki decision, Kruzycki,
okay,
which
thank
is
you.
And as I indicated, the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in the Smith decision followed up on that. I believe it was the Kunz decision that called this the longstanding law of the view of Wisconsin, but perhaps in my rebuttal time I can give you a pinpoint cite to that.
All right, that would be fine. Thank you.
Okay. The other point that I wanted to make, and I am, I think, down to just a couple of minutes here in my initial time, is that the state did not establish beyond a reasonable doubt that telling the jury about Mr. Bassett's three extra convictions did not contribute to the verdict. The state has argued in its brief that we didn't show that it did contribute. It's actually the state's burden to show that the error was harmless. And for a lot of different reasons that I talked about in my brief, primarily the fact that this case came down entirely to a credibility war between the complaining witness and the defendant, credibility was the entire issue in this case. There was nothing else. It was a he said, she said case, one person versus another person as to whether this crime was convicted or this crime occurred or didn't occur.
Mr. And Kelly, didn't the Court of Appeals emphasize that there was a lot of corroborating testimony presented and that as they looked at the situation, that was part of their harmless error analysis?
Well, the corroborating testimony that they talked about was simply the fact that the complaining witness told other people that it happened. That doesn't corroborate anything. That just means that she told the story over and over. There is absolutely no corroborating witness, no corroborating evidence. No other witnesses claimed to have seen a sexual assault. There was no physical evidence that supported her story, no medical evidence that supported her story. The story was inconsistent in many respects. She had a motive to fabricate a false accusation. People who interacted with the family, including a social worker, saw no evidence that sexual assault of behavior had occurred. Again, it really came down just to her word against his word. And in those kinds of cases, this Court and the Court of Appeals have, in the past, in the Pitch decision in 1985, in the Romero decision in 1988, have said if credibility is the issue in a case, improperly admitted evidence that affects credibility cannot be harmless, and that is the case here.
Would you address the issue of waiver?
Sure. I think that this Court has held for, since at least the early 1970s, that it is fair to allow the party who is calling a witness to introduce that witness's convictions as a means of minimizing prejudice, as a means of avoiding having the jury think, boy, this lawyer put that witness on the witness stand but didn't tell me that he had criminal convictions. And that leads juries to think that this lawyer must be hiding something from me. In 1971, this Court held in Nicholas that frequently a party's own attorney will elicit this information on direct examination in the hope that the impact of this information on the jury will be less than if it is brought out, if it is brought out in direct instead of on cross-examination. This tactic is permissible. The Court of Appeals held in 1978 that there is no waiver if that happens. In 1985, this Court said in the Pitch decision that that's the usual trial strategy. It has become the standard practice in civil cases and in criminal cases in Wisconsin, and it is the fair practice for the reasons that are explained in Nicholas and Bailey and Van Loo and Pitch. There is simply no reason to disturb what is at least 30 years of trial practice in this state based on a federal decision that is going to a rule of administration that simply isn't precedential for Wisconsin's rule of administration, including rules of waiver. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Nashhold.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jennifer Nashhold, and I represent the state of Wisconsin in this matter. I'm very tempted to dive right into the issues that have been raised by the Court at this point, because I think that the Court has raised some very, very significant issues and has addressed some major weaknesses in the defense's case here. And I hope to get to that. But first I want to address something that has not been spoken about at this point, and that is the issue of remedy in this case. The defense in this case suggests that the remedy is automatically a new trial. And he cites no support for this authority, and it was not even hinted at by the Court of Appeals that if they didn't find harmless error in this case, that they would have given the defendant a new trial. In fact, the Court of Appeals decision suggests otherwise. And what the Court of Appeals found to be error in this case was that the circuit court did not exercise its discretion and address the second prong of the statute, which allows for admission of prior convictions. And it said that the court did not engage in a required analysis, and that's debatable, I'll get to that, but a required analysis that it's required to analyze whether the prejudicial effect substantially outweighs the probative value. And that was the flaw that the court saw in looking at the circuit court's decision here. And so The remedy is to remand to the trial court in this case to exercise its discretion. And I hope that if the defendant prevails on all of his claims on appeal, that that is the remedy that this court adopts. Now, I want to get to something that Justice Prosser was discussing at length with defense counsel in this case.
I'm sorry, Ms. Nashall. Suppose that we take that remedy, goes back to the trial court. The trial court says, aha, I should have made the balance. I didn't. Had I made the balance, I would have said, don't bring it in. Aren't we back to harmless error?
Yes, I'm assuming that the defendant would have prevailed on his harmless error analysis here. I'm assuming that the defendant would have prevailed on his harmless error analysis here and that it goes back to the circuit court.
Why should we send it back? What the Court of Appeals did was say, okay, we assume there was error here. We assume that had the trial court made the balance, it would have excluded this evidence.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter because that error is harmless. It didn't affect the did undermine confidence in the verdict. So why send it back?
I'm not saying it should, okay, that this court should send it back. If you find harmless error, that's even better.
That's the end of the case.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, Justice Prosser was talking about what the responsibility, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but what the responsibility essentially is of defense counsel in these cases. Is it enough for a defense attorney simply to say, that's really old, that's darn old, we shouldn't be considering that, particularly in light of the fact that we don't have any rule like the federal courts do of precluding convictions that are 10 years old or more? Is that enough? Now, the defense attorney in this case did do a little more than that. She argued that these were too old, and she also stated that they didn't bear on credibility, which, in fact, one of them, the one from 1973, uttering, likely did. But I argued in my brief that this was sufficient to raise the issue, or that these factors automatically are factors that go into the prejudicial effect versus the probative value, and that the court implicitly ruled on this issue, contrary to the Court of Appeals decision in this case, by addressing those particular factors that were raised by the defendant. And as I stated in my brief, there is some contradiction as to whether four of the factors that are considered are just part of the whole analysis of the prejudicial versus the probative effect, or whether the prejudicial versus probative effect is a separate factor. But courts have said, both this court and the Court of Appeals, that when you look at things like rehabilitation, when you look at things like the nature of the crimes and the age of the crimes, that these bear on prejudicial versus probative effect. And if the defendant is arguing here that it's sufficient, that what the defendant did was sufficient, then it cuts against the Court of Appeals' decision in this case that the trial court did not engage in weighing the probative versus the prejudicial effect. Now, I think that what I said in my brief is a reasonable interpretation of what occurred in this case, that defense counsel did raise the issue of prejudicial versus probative effect, and that the court implicitly ruled on that, especially in light of the fact that the prosecutor comes back and says, well, the fact that there's this, you know, pattern that there are some in the 70s and then again in the 90s is significant, that is sufficient for the court to have implicitly ruled on that. However, if this court disagrees with my construction of what occurred at trial and says that instead this was not sufficient, that this just bore on the first component and that it wasn't sufficient to raise this issue of prejudicial versus probative effect, then I would submit that that it's harmful to the defendant's case in that scenario too, because then the defendant did not do enough for the court to look at this issue, to be compelled to look at this issue. And that's really significant here, because the second prong of the statute at issue does not say anything about the court is required in all cases, sua sponte, no matter whether raised by the defendant or not, to address whether the prejudicial effect is outweighs the probative value. It says that a court may do this, or it says that the evidence may be excluded if the court finds this. And so it's not a mandatory statute. It's a directory statute, and it directs the court to that it may do that. And so,
Ashold, doesn't our case law make it clear that this is a two-step process?
I have been unable to find any case that specifically states that a court must, in all cases, engage in this analysis when it's not raised by the defendant in looking at whether prior convictions are admissible.
So you read 906.09.2 as basically discretionary, that in some instances the court should do it, but if it's not really argued, the court doesn't have to?
I think that a defense attorney has the responsibility to raise that issue specifically, because it is a very specific issue, and that the judge, in the words of Justice Prosser, shouldn't have to write the script itself, that the defendant has a responsibility to engage in that type of analysis if that's the problem that the defendant sees. Because otherwise, as here, the defendant may not have a problem with the probative value or the prejudicial effect. It could just have a problem with, hey, these are too darn old. You can't consider them. It could be based on a misconception of the law that we follow the federal rule, or that there's this presumption that we just don't allow these very old convictions.
Well, if we're talking about implicit arguments and implicit decisions, isn't it implicit in the argument being made by defense counsel that this is prejudicial to her client?
That is what I argued in my brief, and I stand on that today. I think that it probably is enough here. What the defense attorney did is enough, and that the trial court implicitly ruled on it, in which case the Court of Appeals was wrong to say that it didn't. But I'm saying if this court disagrees with me and interprets the defense attorney's argument differently, then it's still unavailing for the defendant, because then the defense attorney didn't do enough at the trial court.
Well, could I make the statute talks, evidence of a conviction or an adjudication of delinquency may, and you stressed may, be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice.
Exactly.
There is no reference in the text on page 129 of Bassett's brief. There's no reference to prejudice here.
That's a very critical point, and I'm afraid that even today I've been a bit sloppy in presenting my argument and just talking about prejudicial versus probative effect. That's not the inquiry here. The inquiry is whether the prejudicial effect the probative effect was substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. And what is the unfair prejudice? Blinka has suggested that the danger of unfair prejudice stems from the fact that the jury might consider these convictions in the following way, and we all know it, that, oh, he was bad then, he's bad now. And precautions were taken in this case to assure that that did not happen, even by the prosecutor himself during argument, and by the court itself in its instruction. The instruction given here did not emphasize the amount of convictions. It only talked about the fact that there were prior convictions. And that instruction would have been the same regardless of whether there were five or two convictions. And I think we must not confuse the notion of how prejudicial it is for a jury to be heard, for a jury to hear about some convictions versus the difference between two and five. We are not talking today about no convictions versus some. Certainly there's a much, much stronger argument that a jury that it would tip the scales in a close case if a defendant had some versus none. But that's not the issue here. And the defendant has not cited a single case to support the idea that just because prior convictions are relevant for admissibility because they bear on credibility, that a jury is required to consider them for credibility and that a jury is required to chip away at a witness's credibility based on each particular conviction. That just flies in the face of common sense as well, that a jury is going to say, okay, well, I'm not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that he committed these crimes with these two convictions. Oh, he had five convictions. Well, then I am convinced beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, no, sometimes the problem with arguing common sense is that my common sense is not the same as someone else's common sense, and so I'm sure it might be sensible, but it's not common.
Okay. Fair enough.
And for instance, you know, these people here sitting in the audience, if I were a defendant, you know, and I look like a defendant, however defendants look, and the question to me was, have you been convicted of a crime? And the answer is yes. And how many times? And I say twice. And they might say, in her lifetime, she apparently had some brushes with the law. You know, they don't know. I mean, they might think, oh, my God, she's awful. But they might say, brushes with the law. In fact, their cousin Bob, maybe, was 10 years ago arrested for OWI. And when he was a kid and running around at age 19, he had a disorderly conduct, you know. But Bob's now, you know, 50 and he's fine. But two, you know. But if here I am a defendant, and you say, have you been convicted of a crime? I say, yes. And how many times? 10. Ooh. You got someone who's, I don't know if a hardened criminal, but someone who is quite familiar with the criminal justice system. So your argument is two isn't any different than five. Well, I don't know if common sense tells me that. I use 10 for exaggeration. But I think some people here might say, five, that's not just a few times running around as a 19-year-old kid whose hormones are all going crazy and so he's going to get into trouble.
If we want to use the example of 10, though, then we would say, is there a significant difference between, say, 7 and 10? I think that would be more analogous to the circumstances here where we've got 2 and 5. And it's important to consider that the jury doesn't know when those convictions occurred, what they were for, whether they were minor or significant.
7 versus 10 might be, but I'll tell you the way I hear it. You know, and I'm not saying I'm sensible. But the way I hear, too, is just as I described it. I mean, you know, I got a number of people, and when you have a large family, there's always someone out there that had done something. You know, I'm not going to name the names, but there's always something. You know, then they grew up and they got married and, you know, everything's fine. But that's different than five to me. And as a trial court judge, now other justices might have a different perception. But that's the danger of, you know, saying,
okay,
in the law, there's no difference between 2 and 5.
And as the Court of Appeals emphasized in this case, had the facts, other facts been different in this case, maybe 2 and 5 would have made a difference, but the court properly analyzed the case in its entirety. It didn't focus on 2 and 5 specifically. It said, hey, had the prosecutor really hammered away at this, we might be in a different place today. But the prosecutor didn't do so. It was basically referred to in the defendant's testimony. It wasn't brought out in the state's case in chief. It was only brought out during its rebuttal closing. And I believe Justice Sykes wants to ask me a question. So.
Yeah, I didn't. Just to follow up on Justice Bradley's question, isn't there at the very least a problem in the Court of Appeals opinion with the language in paragraph 34 in which the court states rather unequivocally that once a jury is apprised of a witness's past criminal conduct, evidence of the exact number of the witness's prior convictions will rarely be outcome determinative. Isn't that problematic language?
It does say rarely, but I think if you look at the Court of Appeals decision as a whole, it doesn't suggest that it will certainly never be persuasive or it will never be harmless.
Well, the inquiry on harmless error analysis isn't whether the error is outcome determinative, but what the impact of the error was on the verdict.
Right.
So that, I mean, as I see it, that language is problematic.
And I think that's what the dissent seized on, is that idea, and that's why it reached the conclusion it did in saying, you know, it's ipso facto, never harmless error. And I just think that's if you look at the case as a whole, that's not what the case is about, and that if there's problematic language there, it's basically mitigated by reading the case as a whole and looking at what other considerations they looked at, which were plenty, including the strength of the state's case.
So basically, you would agree with the defense, if this was the case, as the defense, I'm talking about the defense, excuse me, the dissent, laid out the proposition that it was, there is a difference between 9 times and 57 times, so that isn't the case here. It's either 2 or 5 under these circumstances. So that's what we look at when we talk about harmless error. Certainly, as we go down this bench, and I was thinking of being, when I was a trial judge, of course, I think I probably would have done the balancing test, I hope. But had I not, I would say there is a difference between 5 times and 50 times. And if you have 50, which is different than this case.
That reads sort of ne'er-do-well, 50.
Well,
but
that's right. And that's what Judge Dyckman was pointing out in his dissent, at least saying that it does not comport with how reasonable or ordinary people think. And if that's a wow factor when you get up into the...
Right, but there was already authority stating that perhaps it would make a difference if it were some versus none or 1 versus 11, the Carnimola decision by the Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. And so that's already being taken into account by the appellate courts that, you know, when you, of course, this court has to draw lines and, you know, okay, 2 versus 10, and, you know, but that's what this court does, and it's difficult in other contexts too, like is there enough for probable cause in various situations, and it's very fact specific, and we have a situation here that's 5 versus 2 with other factors that operate in the state's favor on a harmless error analysis.
Is your understanding Wisconsin's counting rule to be that the greater the number, the less the credibility?
I agree with defense counsel to this extent. I think in terms of admissibility that has been the rationale. That's why our courts have said that you allow not only the fact of conviction but the number of convictions. But I don't think it's fair to conflate the two standards, the standard for admissibility versus the standard for harmless error. An analogous situation would perhaps be that hearsay evidence is admissible because it's considered trustworthy. And that doesn't mean that when the jury is deliberating, it has to view that evidence as more trustworthy than other evidence. I mean, that's just the standard for admissibility. That's why we allow it in. But the jury is never instructed, you have to find the defendant less credible with each subsequent conviction. That's not the jury instruction here.
No, but that's not the admissibility standard either. If there was one conviction, the judge could let it in. And that doesn't matter that there aren't more. One is enough, right?
Right.
Okay. 2 is okay too.
Mm-hmm.
And 10 is okay. But the fact that there's only one doesn't mean you don't let it in. So it's in because even one goes to credibility.
Right.
Okay. So I just didn't understand your distinction. But on page 24 of the blue brief, the defendant's brief, cites State v. Smith. The law presumes that the number of convictions is relevant. Does that mean just that there is a number, or does it mean multiples?
I was reading it as multiples.
Multiples, okay. The court in Smith endorsed the observation that the assumption is that the longer the criminal record, the less credible. There you can't read. You have to read it to be five is more. It makes him less credible than 2. And I don't care which numbers you substitute for 2 and 5. And then Kuntz says it's longstanding. So you got, at least at the surface, without reading the cases more carefully, a seeming conflict in these cases about what these numbers mean.
And I disagree that there is a contradiction here, because I just think that is looking at the standards and why we allow the numbers in, and it doesn't mean that the jury engages in that same presumption or that it is required to do so.
Let me ask. Page 417 of Blinka says this. The rule assumes that the longer the criminal record, the less credible the individual. Do you agree that that correctly states Wisconsin's counting rule?
It does correctly state Wisconsin's counting rule. And the counting rule is, why do you let the convictions in? Wisconsin allows the number of convictions in, and that is the counting rule. The counting rule is not that the jury has to, you know, have this set amount of credibility points and detract with each subsequent conviction.
Well, I've once had a case in the circuit court where the defendant took the stand and testified to his 11 priors, and he was acquitted. So, you know, the jury obviously
exactly
balanced that against the strength of the state's.
You have cases where everybody's been convicted of prior convictions and someone loses and someone wins. Just the fact that people have prior convictions does not mean that they're inherently or patently incredible.
Well, the only reason I raise that is because doesn't the incremental effect of the number of priors and for harmless error analysis depend upon the case as a whole, the strength of the state's case, whether it is a he said, she said, as in this case, with
it does,
no corroborating evidence?
It does depend on the strength of the state's case and also on whatever other factors occur at the trial, you know, how much those convictions are relied on. If the prosecutor got up in closing and said, we can't believe a word he says, look at these convictions, there's no reason to believe this person.
Does it matter at all that the facts of this case, as I recall, indicate that there was a potential for a hung jury? The jury came back, they didn't. Now, the only issue, as I understand this case, is really credibility. The Court of Appeals indicates it's a he said, she said case, and
right.
That sounds accurate to me. And so if the case is a he said, she said case, and credibility is the only issue. And you have a jury that apparently was having difficulty, and now I'm reading into this. I'm saying apparently having difficulty deciding the case, which means, in my mind, this is where I'm reading it in, difficulty whether it's he said or she said, mm-hmm. should believe. So here's the jury in this case, and they have to come back, and the judge then gives the re-instruction, you know.
Right,
you
gotta the re-instruction.
So you can do it as well as anyone else. Come on, let's go, folks.
Well, I'd just like to point out that they were pretty specific in terms of what was happening in the court, in the jury deliberation room. There was one juror who was holding out, apparently, because they said, you know, it's 11-1, we're stuck. And that was when the Allen instruction was given. It wasn't and we don't know why that juror was not going with the rest of them. I think it's fair to assume that since they reached a verdict 20 minutes later after the Allen instruction was given, that it was 11 for conviction and one against it, because they came back 20 minutes later with three convictions. And unless that person has amazing persuasive value and was able to convince everybody else to convict, and so we just don't know what was going on with that one juror. We don't know if the rest of the jurors wanted to convict after 10 minutes. We don't know whether his reasons were reasonable, whether it was a reasonable doubt, or just that he couldn't believe that a person would ever do this kind of thing. I mean, we just don't know. I don't think that can really be stressed too heavily in this case.
The state has the burden in this case of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And if I inartfully stated it in my brief, I certainly don't think that the defendant has the burden.
So the state has to show beyond a reasonable doubt, because they benefited from the error, that the error did not contribute to the verdict. This case is all about credibility. There is an argument advanced by your opposing counsel that if this counting rule means the greater the number, the less the credibility, and you seem to indicate agreement with Blinka on that, then, and this case is all about credibility, then
It would be very difficult. Very many cases revolve around the issue of credibility, and the pernicious nature of these cases is that there are no witnesses. There's no semen involved here. We don't have DNA. We don't have physical evidence. We've got this 15-year-old girl who was assaulted between the ages of 9 and 12 versus the defendant's argument that he didn't do it. And, you know, in looking at the motive for her to lie about this, and, you know, I guess just reading the transcript in its entirety, I was not left with the impression that defense counsel was in the strength of the state's case. And just because the issues revolve around credibility does not necessarily make the state's case weak. And, you know, there are intangibles that we cannot glean from the cold record. And, you know, just the fact that when the girlfriend of the victim's father testified, she said, when the girl came to me with these allegations, she broke down and was sobbing. And that kind of evidence. And defense counsel points out in his brief that, oh, well, she still maintained this contact with him, said she loved him after she moved away. Well, that actually operates in the state's favor on a harmless error analysis because she didn't have any motive. She did not hate the defendant. She had very mixed feelings, and she had no motive to fabricate these allegations of sexual assault 3 times a week for 3 or 4 years of her life. And, you know, I would be hard-pressed to find an error that is not harmless then. If this isn't de minimis in a he-said-she-said case, I don't know what would be, because I just don't think this court should articulate a rule that whenever there's no corroborating evidence that any error that occurs is not harmless, which is almost what the defendant is stating in this case, that anything could possibly tip the scales in this kind of case, and that's just, I don't think that's borne out.
I have to ask you a question. I think when Justice Bradley asked you if you agreed with the defendant's position on the counting rule, initially when you spoke about it, I didn't think that you agreed. I thought you agreed that courts may let it in because the statute presumes that any conviction bears on credibility, and so that's a standard that they let in, and they don't keep out, if there's one, they don't keep two out if they believe two should come
right
in. But I thought you disagreed with his position that the jury was instructed, or there's any evidence that the jury used counting as a factor in its determination.
Right. I think that is my position, and there is a huge difference. I interpret the counting rule to be something that lets it in, that lets the jury consider the number. It doesn't make the jury consider the number, and that basically defense counsel conflates the two. That creates a contradiction that simply doesn't exist in Wisconsin law at this time, and that there's just no need to overrule the Court of Appeals harmless error analysis here.
Ms. Nashel, speaking of the error analysis, on page 20 of your brief, you say that Harvey is not substantively different from the Court's prior articulation of the harmless error test, that is, whether there's a reasonable possibility that the error contributed to the conviction. A reasonable possibility is a possibility sufficient to undermine our confidence in the conviction, citing Williams, a 2002 case. That's still your position?
Yes.
Okay. So you and the defendant, as I understand, agree that that's the test. You just disagree.
Yes, this Court has interpreted reasonable possibility as the same as reasonable probability in Dias, so I think I would have been equally justified in using the term reasonable probability, but since he used reasonable possibility, I welcome the burden, as they say in the trial court.
All right. My second question is 906092 is your balancing. It is, as I read it, precisely the same as 90403, which applies across the board, although relevant evidence may be excluded on the balancing. Why do you think they put it in? They is us, I think. I didn't check the history. Why did we put it in twice?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Can I just end on that? Because I really don't. I mean,
come on, you can
No, I'm just kidding. But I don't know why they would have done that. And I suppose because the first prong suggests that it is admissible regardless, perhaps. And perhaps they just wanted to emphasize the fact that the court still may engage in this weighing.
Justice Prosser has a question.
I may. The Chief made reference to 90403, and I have been looking at 90404, and I'm reminded of the greater latitude rule. Do the principles of the greater latitude rule apply to 90609?
In what sense? I guess
you have a juvenile, you have a sexual assault. It's a matter of credibility. Seems to me we would apply the greater latitude rule if there were other acts that might bear.
Well, the fact that these convictions were from the 70s, I think we'd be in a much different position had there been no convictions in the 90s. But the fact that there are these convictions in the 90s makes these other convictions more probative, because one of the factors is, has the defendant been rehabilitated? And I think in looking at the record in this case, the answer would be no, he hasn't. He was convicted of these three crimes in the 1970s, and in the 1990s engages in domestic assault twice.
Thank you, Ms. Hold. Counsel, Mr. Kelly.
If the State's position is right, and if there's no difference to a jury between two convictions and five convictions, why are we telling juries how many convictions there are? If it doesn't matter, if they're going to look at two the same way they look at five, why don't we just tell them the defendant has been convicted or the defendant has a criminal record and leave it at that?
Well, is there a difference between one and two?
Yeah, you're doubling question. The number of convictions.
That's right. It's a question of degree. And it's obvious that that's why the dissent said, you know, well, when you get the difference between 9 and 57 is something that I think that most people would say that is. But here it's the difference between 2 and 5. And I
right.
say that.
And the difference between 2 and 5 means that the number of convictions that the jury erroneously heard about doubled or was double, more than double, the number that they should have heard about.
Does it make a difference that we're talking about the defendant as a witness as opposed to a disinterested witness?
I'm not sure that it does. I think it makes a difference in terms of how critical that witness is to the defendant's defense. And in this case, the only defendant or the only witness who really had any a critical role to play was the defendant, because he was the only person other than the complaining witness who knew whether it happened or didn't happen. So I think what makes it critical is what knowledge do they have.
You remark on the lack of corroborating evidence. With the kind of sexual assault that was alleged, was there any type of physical evidence that you would have expected could have been produced?
No, but that doesn't change the fact that that just makes it a weaker case for the State to
prosecute. Well, it just means that factor doesn't bear on this case. I mean, every factor that could possibly bear on a sexual assault isn't relevant to every case,
well,
right?
Sure. Right.
Okay. There are other types of corroborating evidence other than physical corroborations. What kinds would you have thought might have been here that we don't see? Anything?
Well, there isn't any here. I mean, I suppose
there isn't any, but I'm asking you.
Right.
You're pointing out the absence, and I'm saying with touching, you aren't going to have DNA. You aren't going to have evidence that we sometimes have in sexual assaults.
Right.
And I guess I'm asking you, you say there's no corroborating evidence. Okay, you and I can agree. Physical evidence is just not relevant to this charge. Is there any other type of corroborating evidence that could have been provided?
I suppose relevant evidence might have been if there were witnesses who saw the defendant apparently touching the complaining witness or actually touching the complaining witness inappropriately, if there had been instances in which the complaining witness was so frightened of the defendant that she didn't want to have anything to do with him, when in fact the evidence was quite the opposite, that she wanted to be with him and enjoyed being with him. So there are those kinds of corroborating evidence that you could find in a sexual assault that didn't involve semen analysis and DNA and that sort of thing. But none of that was here, which again just makes this a case that makes it all the more difficult for the state to meet its burden of showing that evidence going to credibility was harmless. Again, it's the state's burden to prove that. And the state can only speculate that a jury would view five as not being any different than two. That doesn't meet the test. You can't just speculate and say, well, five and two, they're not that far apart, and so it wouldn't have made a difference. If Wisconsin law is based on the notion that it does make a difference, and that's why we tell juries that there are five instead of two, I think it is... It makes my mind explode to think that at the same time we're saying, well, we're presuming that juries treat five differently than they treat two, but it's harmless anyway. It just doesn't make sense.
Mr. Kelly,
yes.
Ms. Nashhold was making an argument that you don't necessarily get a new trial if you prevail among the court here. That there should be some kind of a hearing. Do you want to tear into that?
That's a new one on me. There was wrongly admitted evidence that isn't harmless. The remedy for that is a new trial. It's always been a new trial. That's what happens in case after case after case. This court reverses and sends it back for a new trial. I'm not sure if the remedy is, well, go back to the judge and let the judge do it all over again. First of all, I think we'd be right back here if the judge didn't exclude the three convictions, because it's not a rational discretionary decision. But beyond that, I think that would set a terrible precedent, because the path of least resistance, obviously, for any trial judge who doesn't want to hold a new trial is to say, well, if I had applied the correct rule, I would have ruled that way anyway. And I think that's why this court doesn't send cases back for a new hearing when there has been erroneously admitted evidence that contributes to a verdict. The court says you're entitled to a new trial. Do it again.
Is this court entitled to review the record and do the balancing itself?
No, because the record doesn't allow this court to balance. I think the court would have to be exercising discretion that the trial court should have exercised in the first instance, because if you don't know what decision the trial court would have made had it applied the correct legal test. In this case, the court might be able to look at it and say, well, you know, there's only one reasonable conclusion, and that is that the three should have been excluded. But I don't think there's any possibility that the Supreme Court could review these facts and say, well, the judge should have, had the judge exercised discretion appropriately, the judge would have admitted them. Given the factors that go into the test to determine the admissibility of conviction evidence.
Thank you. Mr. Kelly. Thank you, Ms. Nashhold, and especially in making an argument when the heat was on you because your father's here. Good to see you, Mr. Nashhold. That concludes our argument in 01-3393-CR, State v. Gary, M.B. Thank you both for an excellent argument on these difficult issues. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.